George Mitchell, the former senator and the former negotiator, U.S. negotiator in Northern Ireland in the 1990s. A year, on January 22, 2009, Mitchell was named the new chief U.S. envoy in the Middle East by President Barack Obama. This is just a couple of days into the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
And when Mitchell spoke at the State Department about this, and all the, you know, the big shots at the State Department were there and the media and so forth, he told a quote-unquote joke, and this was the joke. He said he had been in Jerusalem recently, and he had referred to the 800-year-long conflict in Ireland and his, you know, his involvement in that back in the 90s. And he said that afterwards an elderly gentleman came up to him and said, "Did you say 800 years? And he said, "Yes, 800. And the elderly gentleman said, "Ah, such a recent conflict, no wonder you settled it." And all the people there laughed knowingly, and I put knowingly in quotation marks, because they all quote-unquote know that the conflict between Arabs and Jews, or Muslims and Jews, has been going on not for 800 years, but for thousands of years back to the beginning of time. And that's kind of the conventional wisdom that's accepted by probably the majority of the population in the United States, because we've been told that so many times, and the only problem with that is that it's not true. It's a complete falsification, and I say a malicious misrepresentation of the real causes of the conflict there, and it's a representation of the conflict there that's intended to get somebody and something off the hook, and that somebody and something is Western colonialism, which shaped the area and out of which grew the boundaries of the modern Middle East, not hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago, but at the end of World War One, which ended in 1918. And also the other major factor that shaped the region was the Zionist movement that arose in Europe as a reaction to anti-Semitism, which was very terrible anti-Semitism in Europe and in the United States too, but which also evolved into a colonial project. And as I point out in the book, the leaders of that movement in the early 1900s, late 1800s and early 1900s, up to the time of the creation of the State of Israel in 1947, were very conscious about the fact that while their movement was a reaction to response to anti-Semitic racism in Europe, it was itself also a Euro-supremacist movement that didn't take into account, or consider that had to take into account, the rights of the indigenous people in Palestine. And I don't single it out. It's not the only movement like that. All of the Euro-supremacist colonial movements, the movements that grew out of Europe, including the one that settled the United States of America, had the same view, that the rights of the indigenous people did not have to be taken into consideration. So that's where my starting point in the book, in the first part of it. And the aim of the book, to a very large degree, is to document that, mainly out of the words of the people who were involved in both the Zionist movement and in the other countries in Europe who gave their support to the creation of the State of Israel.
Do you see any parallels between the Palestinians being displaced and the people in the U.S. living in Native American lands?
Well, there's no question about that. and certainly, I'm pretty familiar with the area that you're in. I grew up in Rochester, and I went to college in Oswego. And, you know, I think the first conscious, the first moment of social consciousness in my life was when I was 7 years old, and I ended up with my family. They were driving and going through the Seneca Reservation that's near Allegheny State Park, and being, as a seven-year-old, being shocked by the conditions there. And what happened with the indigenous people in the United States, in the Americas in general, but particularly and most severely in the United States, was a policy of extermination. I live now in California. That's where I am, in San Francisco. In California, there are at least 57 extinct languages. No one speaks them anymore. And 150 years ago, all those languages were spoken languages. They're all gone. And most of the native population in this state, the state that I live in now in California, was wiped out between the discovery of gold and the gold rush in 1848 and the end of the U.S. Civil War in 1865. So a period of 17 years, 90 to 95% of the indigenous population of California was wiped out. There was, up until the 1920s, there was still a law in the books in California that you would, if a white person brought in a scalp of an indigenous person, they were given a bounty. There was a state bounty for that. So what happened, the difference is, and it's a very critical difference, is that the Palestinians, and this is not to say that the native people are gone. I know there's been big struggles there, the Oneida, and over land, and a number of other important struggles that continue on. But the situation today is very different in Palestine than I think that the founders of the Zionist Project imagined. They imagined, as David Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of the State of Israel, said, about the Palestinian refugees, three-quarters of the population was driven out in 1948. He said, the old will die and the young will forget, meaning that they, you know, he hoped they would go the way of the indigenous people in the United States, what became the United States. But that's not what's happened. So today, for the first time since 1948, within the last couple of years, inside what was the British colony or mandate of Palestine, that is what would today be composed of Israel inside its 1948 borders, Gaza and the West Bank. For the first time since that, what happened 60 years ago, what the Palestinians call al-Nakba, or the catastrophe, the population is roughly equivalent between Palestinians and Israelis. And the population, the demographic trend, means that if it is not already, very soon the Palestinian population will surpass the Israeli Jewish population. So here's an existential reality, not in some grand philosophical sense, but existential reality in the most basic sense, is that the Palestinian population has not disappeared. The Palestinians have not gone the route that most of the native people here suffered, that is, being either wiped out altogether or confined to reservations. They are there, and they're not going away. And in fact, there's, you know, the demographic issue, and this is called in Israel today the demographic problem. That's one that thus means that while the intentions and the methods were in many ways very similar, the outcome has not been the same as to what happened to the indigenous people here.
Mm-hmm. And what is the U.S.'s role, or could you talk about the role or our motives in continuing to send arms to Israel?
Well, yes, and it's very interesting. I talk about this in the book. I go over the book, by the way, is not a groundbreaking academic study. I'd say that very clearly. It's instead, I've visited the area and I've spoken about this in many, many times. And in the last few years, people have asked me many times when I've spoken about the issue, what's a good book to start with? And I couldn't. While there's hundreds, thousands of books, there's not one that I could come up with that's contemporary, that's a good starting point, that doesn't attempt to be, you know, it's not an academic study. It's a trying to be clear and includes discussing what the role of the United States has been and how that role has evolved. So when the United States government in the 1940s supported the creation of the State of Israel, and that support was critical, it wasn't for reasons that might seem so today. It wasn't because they saw Israel as a base to use. It wasn't because they were sympathetic to Jewish people either. And in fact, there was a great deal of anti-Semitism that was still rampant, including in the highest circles of U.S. society. They had refused to do anything when the war was raging, and this is very well documented, to even slow down the rate of mass murder going on in the Nazi concentration camps. But after the war, for political reasons, both domestic and international political reasons, the U.S. supported the State of Israel, but it wasn't until the 1967 war that the military relationship was really culminated. And the 1967 war was presented, like many of the other myths that I attempt to address, is presented as, well, that was a war of self-defense by the State of Israel. But later, the generals and even the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, and I quote them in the book as saying, oh, yes, well, we said that we were facing extermination, but that was just a bluff. That was an aggressive war where Israel succeeded in conquering the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights and Egypt's Sinai Peninsula that went back to Egypt later. But the rest of those areas remain under Israeli control. And the U.S. government at that time was very tied down in Vietnam. 500,000 U.S. troops were in Vietnam, and there was great fear of indigenous revolutionary movements in the Middle East. And so after Israel administered this defeat to particularly Syria and Egypt, the leading progressive Arab states at the time, as they were seen, this was followed by Nixon coming in 1969, and when Nixon came in, he instituted what's known as the Nixon Doctrine. And the Nixon Doctrine said that Israel should be supplied, and Iran, which was then under the Shah of Iran, who the CIA had put back on the throne 15 years earlier, that Iran and Israel would become the proxy powers to control the United States and act against national liberation movements and other resistance forces in the region, and should make sure that that the Middle East, with its vast oil reserves, remains safe for U.S. exploitation, U.S. oil companies' exploitation. Mm-hmm. So that's when it started. And the aid turned in the early 70s. It went from having been tens or hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to billions of dollars of aid. So that by 1979, if you counted it in U.S. in present contemporary 2009 dollars, mm-hmm. the aid was up to $14 billion. From the United States. I mean, this is enormous because I think the population of Israel at the time was around 4 million people. So just a vast river of money and military supplies, including a lot of high-tech military equipment, has continued to flow. And so just a few weeks ago, President Obama announced, despite having promised to look for a just settlement in the region, that the U.S. was beginning an additional 10 years of $3 billion, and that's probably a minimal figure. It's probably not the real figure. But $3 billion a year for another 10 years to Israel. And I argue in the book that the real reason for this is this, basically the same reason that that Nixon started the Nixon Doctrine and the aid began to really flow at that time. It's because Israel acts as an adjunct military power to the United States as an extension of Pentagon military power in the Middle East. And the Middle East is really the center of, as we can all see, has been for a number of years the center of the conflict in the world. The world's running out of oil. 70% of the known reserves are there. Probably another 10% are in the Caspian Basin, which Afghanistan borders on. So these wars should really be seen in that context, and the U.S. support for Israel should be seen in this context as well. It's not out of, again, it's not out of sympathy for the for Jewish people or for any people. That's not what motivates U.S. foreign policy, or for us, I should say. It's not really about the people here either. Mm-hmm. It's about power and profit mm-hmm. and empire, and Israel is an essential component part of the U.S. empire.
Going back to that, what was taking place under Nixon, do you think that that was happening at that time as they were realizing that peak oil was something that was taking place, or was that a little before that?
I don't think that they cared about that.
Okay.
To tell you the truth, it wasn't before then. I remember being in high school in the early 60s. And there was a discussion going on then about the, oil's a finite resource. Mm. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting to me, I've kind of thought about that a number of times, that discussion disappeared for about 30 years. it wasn't something new that sprang up in the 1990s. It was that I think it was deliberately downplayed for a long period of time. And I don't think that they care much about it. I think they're much more in you know, what's going to happen this year and next year and during this administration or the next administration or during the tenure of the CEOs of the oil companies than they care about the future, which is one of the reasons that they shouldn't be in control of the world's oil.
Mm-hmm.
They're dangerous, and they're dangerous first and foremost because they don't think about the future. What they do think about is the present and you know the near-term future and control of these resources. I think that the Nixon doctrine, what emerged there was a prelude to, and really there's a continuity that goes all the way back to World War II. There's been 12 administrations. Many of them have had their own doctrines in relation to the Middle East. There was the Truman Doctrine, then there was the Eisenhower Doctrine, and then Nixon, and the Carter Doctrine, and there was a Reagan Doctrine, and you know, and on and on. And all of them, while they have different names for the doctrine, the aim has been remarkably consistent, and that is to defeat the progressive revolutionary, whether they were socialist or communist or nationalist movements throughout the region, and not only in the Middle East but in the world. And William Bloom, for people who have never seen it, wrote a great book called Killing Hope, which is little short episodic chapters of how this has gone on all over the world since World War II, and the defeat of the progressive movements as having, by unlimited violence in many cases, has been a consistent aim of U.S. foreign policy, and in fact, one of the main reasons for the rise of many of the fundamentalist movements today is that they are filling a vacuum that was created by the crushing of secular movements that was a central aim of U.S. policy. But that policy continues down to the present. They don't really care in Washington so much whether the movements are secular or have a religious orientation. They don't want to have in the Middle East any independent states, which is why Iran is being targeted to the degree that it is, or any independent progressive movements, whether it's the Palestinian movement or in Lebanon or in Iraq or wherever. The aim is to destroy those movements and to subjugate the states that exist. And it's in that context that the U.S. support for Israel means that we should look at what happened in Lebanon back in the summer of 2006, or what happened in Gaza a year ago. We should see those as joint operations, not just Israeli operations.
Mm-hmm. We watched the film Life in Occupied Palestine, and it talked about how even the borders that had been set for Israel and Palestine, how Israelis have been building the wall out past the decided borders and more into the Palestinian land. You would like to speak to that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what you said is very, very true. It's a process of what the Israeli leadership has called for many years, creating facts on the ground.
Mm.
Meaning, whatever is written on paper is one thing, but we can create, you know, new realities on the ground. And the wall is a major way of doing that. And the wall is created incredible hardship for the Palestinians who live near it, people who can't go to their schools anymore, farmers cut off from their land, people isolated from their families, and I mean, it's a horrific thing. It's not the only facts on the ground that are being created, and not the only it's not the only de facto annexation of land that's taking place, because there are now 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and there's probably 3 million Palestinians there. But the settlements have taken over huge areas. They're many times based on, they're placed on the top of hills, and of course it's a very hilly area. So you have this situation. I mean, I've been there a number of times. You can the settlements. It's kind of a misnomer, because people often think of settlements as kind of modest or tents or something like that. These are suburbs. These are like completely constructed and militarized suburbs. And they are given all the water they need. Water is a very big issue in this part of the world and a source of great contention. But you can look up from down at the Palestinian villages that neighbor them, and which often, you know, have serious water problems, where they'll have water sometimes 3 days a week. But you can look up and you can see these nice lawns, and the settlements have swimming pools, and you know they're very, and they're subsidized by the government, and subsidized by the U.S. government too, I should say, with loan guarantees and more, and not just the U.S. government, but also other organizations in the U.S. that support them, that contribute to them. But so you have this. The reality is, as you said, that there's been a tremendous encroachment on even the 22%. I mean, probably the West Bank comprises 20% of what was historic Palestine, the Palestine that was the British colony after World War One, and yet, even within that 20%, the Palestinians probably have control of somewhere in the neighborhood of just 40% of that land. And so really, we're talking about that the Palestinians have tenuous control over 8% or 10% of historic Palestine. And even that has to come with a big asterisk next to it, because even that land that they supposedly control is constantly invaded by Israeli military forces, who have no compunction and no limits as far as where they can go in what is supposedly Palestinian territory. A number of years ago, the Israeli troops went into the Palestinian Legislative Council meeting, in other words, the governing body, and arrested 30 legislators, took them away and put them in prisons inside Israel, which is a violation of international law. An occupying power cannot transport people, any of the occupied people, inside their own territory, much less into the prisons inside their own territory. But all of this goes on. So the real Palestinian control is extremely tenuous, extremely limited, and in fact, when you come that right down to it, it's non-existent.
Well, hearing about that also reminds me of listening to what happened to Native American people who lived in this country that, you know, it was only to, from the coast to Albany was where the colonists were, and everything that was west of Albany was indigenous people. And then over time, the colonists were breaking their treaties and moving in and creating settlements there. And because of the conflict, the indigenous people were moving out west, trying to get away from it. And you can see where that led to.
Yeah, you absolutely can. And I think that this was very clearly, as I said in the quote that I gave from David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, many, many years ago, that this was the intention. The old would forget, the old would die and the young would forget, and that they would be dispersed and weakened. But a very interesting thing that happened that I talk about in a little bit in the book, and is a very important reality, is that after the 1967 war, when the remainder of historic Palestine, the colony, what had been the British colony, was seized by Israel, the expectation was that this was really, you know, this would really end it once and for all for the Palestinians. They had already been marginalized and discounted, and after 1948. But instead of that happening, the opposite happened. Beginning in 1967, an independent Palestinian movement arose that became very, that was very determined and very widespread among the Palestinians, both inside of Palestine and in the refugee camps in Lebanon and in Jordan and Syria and so forth. And that movement, despite facing incredible odds. I mean, Israel is a leading world military power, fourth or fifth, and under the protection and with the support of the world's first military power, which is the United States, and has inflicted, regular, commonplace torture on all Palestinian political prisoners. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have died. Tens of thousands of homes have been destroyed. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of olive and fruit trees destroyed. I mean, this campaign to really destroy the Palestinians as a people. Despite that, what's happened is that the Palestinians, instead of disappearing, going away, or accepting, that their time was over, have resurged. And despite the fact that their military power is nothing compared to Israeli military power, they're there. And that's what I was referring to as it's not that Israel feels threatened or its supporters feel threatened by Palestinian military power or Arab military power. Israel can defeat, as it's shown, all the Arab countries. It's the only nuclear weapons power in the Middle East, aside from the United States. But the fact that the Palestinians have not gone the way, that their situation has not evolved into the situation of the defeat inflicted on the Native American people here, and again saying the Native American people are still here and still fighting for their rights, and we support them. But you have this situation of equivalent numbers of people in the population, and that is the existential threat, I think, from the point of view of Israel and its supporters.
Mm. If you're just tuning into this radio program, my guest is Richard Becker. And his latest work is, he's the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. Is that your latest work?
It is.
Okay.
And I don't remember. How far is Casanova from Clinton?
Oh, I guess it's about an hour's drive.
It's an hour's drive. And how far are you from Syracuse?
Oh, about 45 minutes.
Oh, so you're a little closer to Syracuse.
I would guess, but I'm not sure about that.
So the schedule is I'm going to be speaking about this and doing book signing in Casanova, mm-hmm, at the United Methodist Church on, I'm not sure how you pronounce this, Linklaen Street?
Oh,
Linklaen,
yeah.
Okay, so that's Friday night in Casanova. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's Thursday night in Casanova on February 25th. So it's a week from, it's a week from tomorrow. And then on Friday, February 26th, I will be speaking at 7 p.m. at the Art Rage Gallery, and that's at 505 Hawley Avenue in Syracuse. If you want to see more about this, people can go to a website called PalestineBook.com. It's a very simple name, PalestineBook.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see a list of the events that are coming up, including the events in that area. And if people are interested in getting a copy of the book, you can order it. You can see some of the testimonials from people, including Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, way back in the Johnson administration. But he's Joel Covell, who was the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate, I think, there in New York a few years ago, and who's himself an author, written Overcoming Zionism. And a number of other people have, written testimonials would say something about the book.
Let me read Ramsey Clark's review of your book.
Sure.
Becker gives us the most focused and penetrating analysis we have of the real dynamics in the continuing persecution of the Palestinian people.
Yeah.
So that's a great review.
Yeah.
Now, both of these events are free and open to the public.
That's right.
And there'll be light food will be provided, and after the presentation, there will be a respectful and lively Q&A.
Yes, and the Q&A is always very good, and we welcome it. And we want to get away, as I said at the beginning, from the myths and the stereotypes, like, the idea that is perpetrated by some supporters of Israel in the United States, that if you talk about this, if you talk about the real history, then that's, you're anti-Semitic. Or if you're Jewish and you talk about the real history, and they say, well, you're a self-hating Jew. These are more of the kind of myths and stereotypes that we want to talk about. We I'm with the Answer Coalition, which is Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. We're preparing for big demonstrations on March 20th, the anniversary of the Iraq War. We are opposed to all forms of racism and bigotry, including anti-Arab racism, anti-Jewish racism, anti-Black racism, all forms of racism. And what we really advocate is that there has to be, in the end, and we believe that this will have to be the outcome, is that at some point there'll have to be another solution, a state that has equal rights for all people, regardless of their nationality and religion. And this idea, which sounds, I think, to many people, well, isn't that what we're all really aiming for, is still treated as if it's an unthinkable and ludicrous idea by the government in Israel and its supporters here in the United States. But that's what we're really fighting for. We fight for equality and against racism and discrimination and bigotry of all type.
I just saw a recent article in Truthout about U.S. expanding its weapons stockpiling in Israel. And it said in the latest one that the money that Obama has recently approved is specifically earmarked for military and not even for civilian use.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, there's no question about it. The aid that is being projected over the next 10 years, not just this year, but over the next 10 years, is all military. It's exclusively military. And it's interesting also to note this, is that Israel is the number one recipient of U.S. military aid. Egypt is number two. But the weapons that are given, that are sent, and the way that it's sent is very, very different between both. The weapons that Israel gets, to a very large degree, are offensive weapons. They're for offensive warfare. What goes to Egypt and its very corrupt government and a dictatorial government that's collaborated with the United States, the Mubarak government, is weapons that are mainly intended to be used against the people of Egypt. In other words, the United States is supporting that government against its own people. And Egypt is the largest of the Arab countries, so keeping the Egyptian people under what is a police state dictatorship is a primary aim of U.S. policy in the region.
What got you interested in the issue of Palestine?
Well, I became involved in politics in the period of the late 60s, the period of the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement. And I had grown up thinking Israel was great. I mean, hating what had happened to Jewish people and other people in World War II at the hands of the Nazis. And I went to Oswego State, and there was the anti-war, like everywhere else, even though it was small there, the anti-war movement developed. And the leader of the movement there was a Jewish guy who was also from Rochester, where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were talking one day, he said, "No, Israel's not cool," you know, or something to that effect. And his family, his entire family was anti-Zionist. They regarded the development of Israel at the expense of the Palestinian people as really a betrayal of a long history of among Jewish people, the struggle for social justice. And so he was the person who first opened my eyes to it. And then I remained a political activist and was involved in many, many different issues and struggles, both in Rochester and then later moving to the West Coast. And, more and more, just over a period of time, became involved in this issue. That's not the only issue that I'm involved in, but writing about it, writing articles, traveling to the region, being active in organizations that were focused on the situation there, and then ended up finally writing this book.
Let me tell listeners, if there's anyone out there who's listening and you'd like to get a question in, you're welcome to give us a call here at the station. The telephone number is 859-4561, 859-4561. and you can get a question in. And is there anything that I haven't covered that you would like to cover?
Well, I hope people will check out the website, PalestineBook.com. I hope people will come to the events if they can in either Casanova or Syracuse. And I think this is an issue that we'd like to have a very open discussion about, and really look at both what the U.S. policy is, what it's doing, what the impact it's having on the region, and what we really think the future can be, a future that would really have justice for all people.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you very much for having me on. I actually have to head off to work.
Okay.
So if that's okay.
Well, thank you for your time. I really appreciate the interview.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Pete.
Take care.
Bye.